Chapter 6. "This is it," Tom said no more than 10 minutes later, and the moon emerged from the rack of cloud and smoke that had obscured it for the last hour or so, as if the little man with the spectacles and the mustache had just given the celestial lighting director a cue. Its rays, silver now instead of that awful infected orange, illuminated a house that was either dark blue, green, or perhaps even gray. Without the streetlights to help, it was hard to tell for sure. What Clay could tell for sure was that the house was trim and handsome, although maybe not as big as your eye first insisted. The moonlight aided in that deception, but it was mostly caused by the way the steps rose from Tom McCourt's well-kept lawn to the only pillared porch on the street. There was a fieldstone chimney on the left. From above the porch, a dormer looked down on the street.
"Oh, Tom, it's beautiful," Alice said in a too rapturous voice.
To Clay, she sounded exhausted and bordering on hysteria. He himself didn't think it beautiful, but it certainly looked like the home of a man who owned a cell phone and all the other 21st century bells and whistles. So did the rest of the houses on this part of Salem Street, and Clay doubted if many of the residents had had Tom's fantastic good luck. He looked around nervously. All the houses were dark, the power was out now, and they might have been deserted, except he seemed to feel eyes surveying them. The eyes of crazies? Phone crazies? He thought of Power Suit Woman and Pixie Light, of the lunatic in the gray pants and the shredded tie, the man in the business suit who had bitten the ear right off the side of the dog's head. He thought of the naked man jabbing the car aerials back and forth as he ran. No, surveying was not in the phone crazies' repertoire. They just came at you. But if there were normal people holed up in these houses, some of them anyway, where were the phone crazies? Clay didn't know.
"I don't know if I'd exactly call it beautiful," Tom said, "but it's still standing, and that's good enough for me. I'd pretty well made up my mind that we'd get here and find nothing but a smoking hole in the ground."
He reached in his pocket and brought out a slim ring of keys. "Come on in. Be it ever so humble and all that." They started up the walk and had gone no more than half a dozen steps when Alice cried,
"Wait!"
Clay wheeled around, feeling both alarm and exhaustion. He thought he was beginning to understand combat fatigue a little. Even his adrenaline felt tired. But no one was there. No phone crazies, no bald man with blood flowing down the side of his face from a shredded ear, not even a little old lady with the talkin' apocalypse blues. Just Alice, down on one knee at the place where Tom's walk left the sidewalk.
"What is it, honey?"
Tom asked. She stood up, and Clay saw she was holding a very small sneaker.
"It's a baby Nike," she said.
"Do you?"
Tom shook his head. "I live alone. Except for Rafe, that is. He thinks he's the king, but he's only the cat."
"Then who left it?"
She looked from Tom to Clay with wondering, tired eyes. Clay shook his head. "No telling, Alice. Might as well toss it." But Clay knew she would not. It was deja vu at its disorienting worst. She still held it in her hand, curled against her waist, as she went to stand behind Tom, who was on the steps, picking slowly through his keys in the scant light.
"Now we hear the cat," Clay thought. "Rafe."
And sure enough, there was the cat that had been Tom McCourt's salvation, wowing a greeting from inside. Chapter 7. Tom bent down, and Rafe, or Rafer, both short for Raphael, leaped into his arms, purring loudly and stretching his head up to sniff Tom's carefully trimmed mustache.
"Yeah, missed you too," Tom said. "All is forgiven, believe me."
He carried Rafer across the enclosed porch, stroking the top of his head. Alice followed. Clay came last, closing the door and turning the knob on the lock before catching up to the others.
"Follow along down to the kitchen," Tom said when they were in the house proper.
There was a pleasant smell of furniture polish and, Clay thought, leather, a smell he associated with men living calm lives that did not necessarily include women.
"Second door on the right," Stay close. The hallway's wide and there's nothing on the floor, but there are tables on both sides, and it's as black as your hat, as I think you can see.
So to speak, Clay said.
Ha ha.
Have you got flashlights? Clay asked.
Flashlights and a Coleman lantern that should be even better. But let's get in the kitchen first.
They followed him down the hallway, Alice walking between the two men. Clay could hear her breathing rapidly, trying not to let the unfamiliar surroundings freak her out. But of course it was hard. Hell, it was hard for him. Disorienting. It would have been better if there had been even a little light. But his knee bumped one of the tables Tom had mentioned, and something that sounded all too ready to break rattled like teeth. Clay steeled himself for the smash and for Alice's scream. That she would scream was almost a given. Then whatever it was, a vase or some knick-knack, decided to live a little longer and settled back into place. Still, it seemed like a very long walk before Tom said, "Here, okay? Hard right." The kitchen was nearly as black as the hall, and Clay had just a moment to think of all the things he was missing, and Tom must be missing more. A digital readout on the microwave oven, the hum of the fridge, maybe light from a neighboring house coming in through the window over the kitchen sink and making highlights on the faucet.
"Here's the table," Tom said. "Alice, I'm going to take your hand. Here's a chair, okay? I'm sorry if I sound like we're playing blind man's bluff."
"It's all right," she began, then gave a little scream that made Clay jump. His hand was on the haft of his knife, now he thought of it as his, before he even realized he'd reached for it.
"What?" Tom asked sharply. "What?"
"Nothing," she said. "Just nothing. The cat, his tail on my leg."
"Oh, I'm sorry."
"It's all right."
"Stupid,"
she added with self-contempt that made Clay wince in the dark.
"No," he said. "Let up on yourself, Alice. It's been a tough day at the office."
"Tough day at the office," Alice repeated, and laughed in a way Clay didn't care for.
It reminded him of her voice when she'd called Tom's house beautiful. He thought, "That's going to get away from her, and then what do I do?" In the movies, the hysterical girl gets a slap across the chops, and it always brings her around. But in the movies, you can see where she is. He didn't have to slap her, shake her, or hold her, which was what he probably would have tried first. She heard what was in her own voice, maybe, got hold of it, and bulldogged it down. First to a choked gargle, then to a gasp, then to quiet.
"Sit," Tom said. "You have to be tired. You too, Clay. I'll get us some light."
Clay felt for a chair and sat down to a table he could hardly see, although his eyes had to be fully adjusted to the dark by now. There was a whisper of something against his pants leg, there and gone. A low meow. Rafe.
"Hey, guess what?"
he said to the dim shape of the girl as Tom's footsteps receded. "Old Rafer just put a jump in me, too." Although he hadn't, not really.
"We have to forgive him," she said. "Without that cat, Tom would be just as crazy as the rest of them, and that would be a shame."
"It would."
"I'm so scared," she said. "Do you think it will get better tomorrow in the daylight? The being scared part?"
"I don't know."
"You must be worried sick about your wife and little boy."
Clay sighed and rubbed his face. "And the hard part is trying to come to grips with the helplessness. We're separated, you see, and..." He stopped and shook his head. He wouldn't have gone on if she hadn't reached out and taken his hand. Her fingers were firm and cool. "We separated in the spring. We still live in the same little town, what my own mother would have called a grass marriage. My wife teaches at the elementary school." He leaned forward, trying to see her face in the dark.
"You want to know the hell of it? If this had happened a year ago, Johnny would have been with her. But this September, he made the jump to middle school, which is almost 5 miles away. I keep trying to figure if he would have been home when things went nuts. He and his friends ride the bus. I think he would have been home. And I think he would have gone right to her.
Or pulled his cell phone out of his backpack and called her," the panic rat suggested merrily, and then bit. Clay felt himself tightening his fingers down on Alice's and made himself stop. But he couldn't stop the sweat from springing out on his face and arms.
"But you don't know," she said.
"No,"
My daddy runs a framing and print shop in Newton, she said. I'm sure he's all right. He's very self-reliant, but he'll be worried about me. Me and my, you know.
Clay knew.
I keep wondering what he did about supper, she said. I know that's crazy, but he can't cook a lick.
Clay thought about asking if her father had a cell phone, and something told him not to. Instead, he asked, Are you doing all right for now?
Yes, she said, and shrugged. What's happened to him has happened. I can't change it.
He thought, I wish you hadn't said that. My kid has a cell phone. Did I tell you that? To his own ears, his voice sounded as harsh as a crow's caw.
You did, actually, before we crossed the bridge.
Sure, that's right. He was gnawing at his lower lip and made himself stop. But he didn't always keep it charged. Probably I told you that, too.
Yes.
I just have no way of knowing. The panic rat was out of its cage now, running and biting. Now both of her hands closed over both of his. He didn't want to give in to her comfort. It felt hard to let go of his grip on himself and give in to her comfort. But he did it, thinking she might need to give more than he needed to take. They were holding on that way, hands linked next to the pewter salt and pepper shakers on Tom McCord's little kitchen table, when Tom came back from the cellar with four flashlights and a Coleman lantern that was still in its box. Chapter 8. The Coleman gave off enough light to make the flashlights unnecessary. It was harsh and white, but Clay liked its brilliance, the way it drove away every single shadow save for their own and the cat's, which went leaping fantastically up the wall like a Halloween decoration cut from black crepe paper into hiding.
I think you should pull the curtains, Alice said.
Tom was in the act of opening one of the plastic sacks from the Metropolitan Cafe, the ones with doggy bag on one side and people bag on the other. He stopped and looked at her curiously.
Why?
She shrugged and smiled. Clay thought it the strangest smile he'd ever seen on the face of a teenage girl. She'd cleaned the blood off her nose and chin, but there were dark, weary circles under her eyes. The Coleman lamp had bleached the rest of her face to a corpse-like pallor, and the smile, showing the tiniest twinkle of teeth between trembling lips from which all the lipstick had now departed, was disorienting in its adult artificiality. He thought Alice looked like a movie actress from the late 1940s playing a socialite on the verge of a nervous breakdown. She had the tiny sneaker in front of her on the table. She was spinning it with one finger. Each time she spun it, the laces flipped and clicked. Clay began to hope she would break soon. The longer she held up, the worse it would be when she finally let go. She had let some out, but not nearly enough. So far, he'd been the one to do most of the letting out.
I don't think people should see we're in here, that's all, she said.
She flicked the sneaker, what she had called a baby Nike. It spun. The laces flipped and clicked on Tom's highly polished table.
I think it might be bad.
Tom looked at Clay. She could be right, Clay said. I don't like us being the only lit-up house on the block, even if the light's at the back. Tom got up and closed the curtains over the sink without another word. There were two other windows in the kitchen, and he pulled those curtains, too. He started back to the table, then changed course and closed the door between the kitchen and the hall. Alice spun the baby Nike in front of her on the table. In the harsh, unsparing glow of the Coleman lantern, Clay could see it was pink and purple, colors only a child could love. Around it went. The laces flew and clicked. Tom looked at it, frowning as he sat down, and Clay thought,
"Tell her to take it off the table. Tell her she doesn't know where it's been, and you don't want it on your table. That should be enough to set her off, and then we can start getting this part out of the way. Tell her. I think she wants you to. I think that's why she's doing it."
But Tom only took sandwiches out of the bag, roast beef and cheese, ham and cheese, and doled them out. He got a pitcher of iced tea from the fridge.
"Still cold as can be," he said,
and then set down the remains of a package of raw hamburger for the cat.
"He deserves it," he said, almost defensively. "Besides, it would only go over with the electricity out."
There was a telephone hanging on the wall. Clay tried it, but it was really just a formality, and this time he didn't even get a dial tone. The thing was as dead as, well, as Power Suit Woman back there by Boston Common. He sat back down and worked on his sandwich. He was hungry, but didn't feel like eating. Alice put hers down after only 3 bites.
I can't, she said. Not now. I guess I'm too tired. I want to go to sleep. And I want to get out of this dress. I guess I can't wash up. Not very well, anyway. But I'd give anything to throw this fucking dress away. It stinks of sweat and blood.
She spun the sneaker. It twirled beside the crumpled paper with her barely touched sandwich lying on top of it.
I can smell my mother on it, too. Her perfume.
For a moment, no one said anything. Clay was at a complete loss. He had a momentary picture of Alice, subtracted from her dress, in a white bra and panties, with her staring, hollowed-out eyes making her look like a paper doll. His artist's imagination, always facile and always obliging, added tabs at the shoulders and lower legs of the image. It was shocking not because it was sexy, but because it wasn't. In the distance, very faint, something exploded with a dim foomp. Tom broke the silence, and Clay blessed him for it.
I'll bet a pair of my jeans would just about fit you if you rolled up the bottoms to make cuffs.
He stood up.
You know what? I think you'd even look cute in them, like Huck Finn in a girls' school production of Big River. Come upstairs. I'm going to put out some clothes for you to wear in the morning, and you can spend the night in the guest room. I've got plenty of pajamas, a plague of pajamas. Do you want the Coleman?
I guess a flashlight would be okay. Are you sure?
Yes,
he said. He took one flashlight and gave her another. He looked ready to say something about the small sneaker when she picked it up, then seemed to think better of it. What he said was,
You can wash, too. There may not be a lot of water, but the taps will probably draw some, even with the power out, and I'm sure we can spare a basinful.
He looked over the top of her head at Clay.
I always keep a case of bottled drinking water in the cellar, so we're not short there.
Clay nodded. Sleep well, Alice, he said.
You too,
she said vaguely, and then more vaguely still.
Nice meeting you.
Tom opened the door for her. Their flashlights bobbed, and then the door shut again. Clay heard their footsteps on the stairs, then overhead. He heard running water. He waited for the chug of air in the pipes, but the flow of water stopped before the air started. A basinful, Tom had said, and that was what she'd gotten. Clay also had blood and dirt on him he wanted to wash off. He imagined Tom did too. But he guessed there must be a bathroom on this floor too. And if Tom was as neat about his personal habits as he was about his person, the water in the toilet bowl would be clean. And there was the water in the tank as well, of course. Rafer jumped up on Tom's chair and began washing his paws in the white light of the Coleman lantern. Even with the lantern's steady, low hiss, Clay could hear him purring. As far as Rafe was concerned, life was still cool. He thought of Alice twirling the small sneaker and wondered, almost idly, if it was possible for a 15-year-old girl to have a nervous breakdown.
Don't be stupid, he told the cat. Of course it is.
Happens all the time. They make movies of the week about it.
Rafer looked at him with wise green eyes and went on licking his paw.
Tell me more, those eyes seemed to say. Were you beaten as a child? Did you have the sexual thoughts about your mother?
I can smell my mother on it, her perfume.
Alice as a paper doll, with tabs sticking out of her shoulders and legs.
Don't be silly, Rafer's green eyes seemed to say. The tabs go on the clothes, not on the doll. What kind of artist are you?
The out-of-work kind, he said. Just shut up, why don't you?
He closed his eyes, but that was worse. Now Rafer's green eyes floated disembodied in the dark, like the eyes of Lewis Carroll's Cheshire Cat.
We're all mad here, dear Alice.
And under the steady hiss of the Coleman lamp, he could still hear it purring. Chapter 9. Tom was gone 15 minutes. When he came back, he brushed Rafe out of his chair without ceremony and took a large, convincing bite from his sandwich.
She's asleep, he said. Got into a pair of my pajamas while I waited in the hall, and then we dumped the dress in the trash together. I think she was out 40 seconds after her head hit the pillow.
Throwing the dress away was what sealed the deal. I'm convinced of it.
A slight pause.
It did indeed smell bad.
While you were gone, Clay said, I nominated Rafe President of the United States. He was elected by acclamation.
Good, Tom said. Wise choice. Who voted?
Millions. Everyone's still sane. They sent in thought ballots.
Clay made his eyes very wide and tapped his temple.
I can read minds.
Tom's chewing stopped, then began again, but slowly.
You know, he said, under the circumstances, that's not really all that funny.
Clay sighed, sipped some iced tea, and made himself eat a little more of his sandwich. He told himself to think of it as body gasoline, if that was what it took to get it down.
No, probably not, sorry.
Tom tipped his own glass to him before drinking.
It's all right. I appreciate the effort.
Say, where's your portfolio?
I left it on the porch. I wanted both hands free while we negotiated Tom McCourt's hallway of death.
That's all right, then.
Listen, Clay, I'm sorry as hell about your family.
Don't be sorry yet, Clay said, a little harshly. There's nothing to be sorry about yet.
But I'm really glad I ran into you. That's all I wanted to say.
Same goes back, Clay said. I appreciate the quiet place to spend the night, and I'm sure Alice does too.
As long as Malden doesn't get loud and burn down around our ears.
Clay nodded, smiling a little.
As long as.
Did you get that creepy little shoe away from her?
No, she took it to bed with her like, I don't know, a teddy bear.
She'll be a lot better tomorrow if she sleeps through tonight.
Do you think she will?
No, Tom said. But if she wakes up scared, I'll spend the night with her. Crawl in with her, if that's what it takes. You know I'm safe with her, right?
Yes.
Clay knew that he would have been safe with her, too, but he understood what Tom was talking about.
I'm going to head north tomorrow morning as soon as it's light. It would probably be a good idea if you and Alice came with me.
Tom thought about this briefly, then asked, What about her father?
She says he's, quote, very self-reliant. Her biggest stated worry on his behalf was what he rolled himself for dinner. What I heard under that is that she isn't ready to know. Of course, we'll have to see how she feels about it, but I'd rather keep her with us, and I don't want to head west into those industrial towns.
You don't want to head west at all.
No, Clay admitted. He thought Tom might argue the point, but he didn't.
What about tonight? Do you think we should stand to watch?
Clay hadn't even considered this until now. He said, I don't know how much good it would do. If a crazed mob comes down Salem Street waving guns and torches, what can we do about it?
Go down cellar?
Clay thought it over. Going down cellar seemed awfully final to him, the bunker defense. But it was always possible the hypothetical crazed mob under discussion would think the house deserted and go sweeping by. Better than being slaughtered in the kitchen, he supposed. Maybe after watching Alice get gang-raped.
It won't come to that, he thought uneasily. You're getting lost among the hypotheticals, that's all. Freaking in the dark. It won't come to that.
Except Boston was burning to the ground behind them. Liquor stores were being looted, and men were beating each other bloody over aluminum kegs of beer. It had already come to that.
Tom, meanwhile, was watching him, letting him work it through, which meant that maybe Tom already had.
Rafe jumped into his lap. Tom put his sandwich down and stroked the cat's back.
Tell you what, Clay said. If you've got a couple of comforters I can bundle up in, why don't I spend the night out there on your porch? It's enclosed and it's darker than the street, which means that I'd likely see anyone coming long before they saw me watching, especially if the ones coming were phone crazies. They didn't impress me as being into stealth.
Nope, not the creep up on you type. What if people come from around and back? That's Lynn Avenue, just a block over.
Clay shrugged, trying to indicate that they couldn't defense against everything, or even very much, without saying so right out loud.
All right, Tom said, after eating a little more of his sandwich and feeding a scrap of ham to Rafe.
But you could come get me around 3. If Alice hasn't woken up by then, she might sleep right through.
Why don't we just see how it goes, Clay said. Listen, I think I know the answer to this, but you don't have a gun, do you?
No, Tom said. Not even a lonely can of mace. He looked at his sandwich and then put it down. When he raised his eyes to Clay's, they were remarkably bleak. He spoke in a low voice, as people do when discussing secret things.
"Do you remember what that cop said, just before he shot that crazy man?"
Clay nodded. "Hey, buddy, how you doing? I mean, what the haps?" He would never forget it.
"I knew it wasn't like in the movies," Tom said, "but I never suspected the enormous power of it, or the suddenness, and the sound when the stuff from his head."
He leaned forward suddenly, one small hand curled to his mouth. The movement startled Rafer, and the cat leaped down. Tom made three low, muscular, irking sounds, and Clay steeled himself for the vomiting that was almost sure to follow. He could only hope he wouldn't start vomiting himself, but he thought he might. He knew he was close, only a feather tickle away, because he knew what Tom was talking about. The gunshot, then the wet, ropey splatter on the cement. There was no vomiting. Tom got control of himself and looked up, eyes watering.
"I'm sorry," he said. "Shouldn't have gone there."
"You don't need to be sorry."
"I think if we're going to get through whatever's ahead, we'd better find a way to put our finer sensibilities on hold. I think that people who can't do that..."
He stopped, then started again.
"I think that people who can't do that..."
He stopped a second time. The third time he was able to finish.
"I think that people who can't do that may die."
They stared at each other in the white glare of the Coleman lamp. Chapter 10. "Once we left the city, I didn't see anyone with a gun," Clay said. "At first I wasn't really looking, and then I was."
"You know why, don't you?"
"Except maybe for California, Massachusetts has got the toughest gun law in the country." Clay remembered seeing billboards proclaiming that at the state line a few years ago. Then they'd been replaced by one saying that if you got picked up for driving under the influence, you'd have to spend a night in jail. Tom said, "If the cops find a concealed handgun in your car, meaning like in the glove compartment with your registration and insurance card, they can put you away for, I think, 7 years. Get stopped with a loaded rifle in your pickup, even in hunting season, and you can get slapped with a $10,000 fine and 2 years of community service." He picked up the remains of his sandwich, inspected it, put it back down again. "You can own a handgun and keep it in your home if you're not a felon, but a license to carry? Maybe if you've got Father O'Malley of the Boys Club to co-sign, but maybe not even then." "No guns might have saved some lives coming out of the city."
"I agree with you completely," Tom said. "Those two guys fighting over the keg of beer? Thank God neither of them had a .38.
Clay nodded. Tom rocked back in his chair, crossed his arms on his narrow chest, and looked around. His glasses glinted. The circle of light thrown by the Coleman lantern was brilliant but small.
"Right now, however, I wouldn't mind having a pistol, even after seeing the mess they make. And I consider myself a pacifist."
"How long have you lived here, Tom?"
"Almost 12 years. Long enough to see Malden go a long way down the road to Shittsville. It's not there yet, but boy, it's going."
"Okay, so think about it. Which of your neighbors is apt to have a gun or guns in their house?" Tom answered promptly.
"Honey Nickerson, across the street and three houses up. NRA bumper sticker on his Camry, along with a couple of yellow ribbon decals and an old Bush Cheney sticker."
"Goes without saying."
"And two NRA stickers on his pickup, which he equips with a camper cap in November and takes hunting up in your part of the world."
"And we're happy to have the revenue his out-of-state hunting license provides," Clay said. "Let's break into his house tomorrow and take his guns." Tom McCourt looked at him as though he were mad.
"The man isn't as paranoid as some of those militia types out in Utah. I mean, he does live in Taxachusetts, but he's got one of those burglar alarm signs on his lawn that basically says, 'Do you feel lucky, punk?' And I'm sure you must be familiar with the NRA's stated policy as to just when their guns will be taken away from them."
"I think it has something to do with prying their cold, dead fingers."
"That's the one."
Clay leaned forward and stated what to him had been obvious from the moment they'd come down the ramp from Route 1. Malden was now just one more fucked-up town in the Unicel States of America, and that country was now out of service, off the hook, so sorry, please try your call again later. Salem Street was deserted. He had felt that as they approached. Hadn't he? No, bullshit. You felt watched. Really? And even if he had, was that the sort of intuition that could be relied upon, acted upon, after a day like this one? The idea was ridiculous. Tom, listen. One of us will walk up to this guy Nackelson's house tomorrow, after it's full daylight. It's Nickerson. And I don't think that's a very smart idea, especially since Swami McCourt sees him kneeling inside his living room window with a fully automatic rifle he's been saving for the end of the world, which seems to have rolled around. I'll do it, Clay said, and I won't do it if we hear any gunshots from the Nickerson place tonight or tomorrow morning. I certainly won't do it if I see any bodies on the guy's lawn, with or without gunshot wounds. I watched all those old Twilight Zone episodes, too, the ones where civilization turns out to be nothing more than a thin layer of shellac. If that, Tom said gloomily, Idi Amin, Pol Pot, the prosecution rests. I'll go with my hands raised, ring the doorbell. If someone answers, I'll say I just want to talk. What's the worst that can happen? He tells me to get lost. No. The worst that can happen is he can shoot you dead on his fucking welcome, Matt, and leave me with a motherless teenage girl, Tom said sharply. Smart off about old Twilight Zone episodes all you want. Just don't forget those people you saw today, fighting outside the T station in Boston. That was... I don't know what it was, but those people were clinically insane. You can't doubt that, Tom. What about Bible-thumping Bertha and the two men fighting over the keg? Were they insane? No, of course they hadn't been. But if there was a gun in that house across the street, he still wanted it. And if there was more than one, he wanted Tom and Alice each to have one, too. I'm thinking about going north over 100 miles, Clay said. We might be able to boost a car and drive some of it, but we might have to walk the whole way. Do you want to go with just knives for protection? I'm asking you as one serious man to another, because some of the people we run into are going to have guns. I mean, you know that. Yes, Tom said. He ran his hands through his neatly trimmed hair, giving it a comic ruffle. And I know that Arnie and Beth are probably not home. They were gadget nuts as well as gun nuts. He was always gabbing on his cell phone when he went by in that big Dodge Ram Detroit Phallus of his. See, there you go. Tom sighed. All right. Depending on how things look in the morning, okay? Okay. Clay picked up his sandwich again. He felt a little more like eating now. Where did they go? Tom asked. The ones you call the phone crazies. Where did they go? I don't know. I'll tell you what I think, Tom said. I think they crawled into the houses and the buildings around sundown and died. Clay looked at him doubtfully. Look at it reasonably and you'll see I'm right, Tom said. This was almost certainly some sort of terrorist act. Would you agree? That seems the most likely explanation. Although I'll be damned if I know how any signal, no matter how subversive, could have been programmed to do what this one did. Are you a scientist? You know I'm not. I'm an artist. So when the government tells you they can guide computerized smart bombs through bunker doors in the floor of the desert from aircraft carriers that are maybe 2,000 miles away, all you can do is look at the photos and accept that the technology exists. Would Tom Clancy lie to me? Clay asked, unsmiling. And if that technology exists, why not accept this one, at least on a provisional basis? Okay, spell it out. Small words, please. At about 3 o'clock this afternoon, some terrorist organization, maybe even a tin pot government, generated some sort of signal or pulse. For now, we have to assume that this signal was carried by every cell phone operating in the entire world. We'll hope that wasn't the case, but for now, I think we have to assume the worst. Is it over? I don't know, Tom said. Do you want to pick up a cell phone and find out? Touchy, Clay said. That's how my little boy says touche. And please God, how he's still saying it. But if this group could transmit a signal that would send everyone hearing it insane, Tom said, isn't it possible that the signal could also contain a directive for those receiving it to kill themselves 5 hours later? Or perhaps to simply go to sleep and stop breathing? I would say that's impossible. I would have said a madman coming at me with a knife across from the Four Seasons Hotel was impossible, Tom said.
or Boston burning flat while the city's entire population, that part of it lucky enough not to have cell phones, that is, left by the Mystic and the Zakim.
He leaned forward, looking at Clay intently. He wants to believe this, Clay thought. Don't waste a lot of time trying to talk him out of it, because he really, really wants to.
In a way, this is no different from the bioterrorism the government was so afraid of after 9/11, he said.
By using cell phones, which have become the dominant form of communication in our daily lives, you simultaneously turn the populace into your own conscript army. An army that's literally afraid of nothing, because it's insane, and you break down the infrastructure. Where's the National Guard tonight?
Iraq, Clay ventured. Louisiana? It wasn't much of a joke, and Tom didn't smile.
It's nowhere. How do you use a homeland force that now depends almost entirely on the cellular network to even mobilize? As for airplanes, the last one I've seen flying was the little one that crashed on the corner of Charles and Beacon.
He paused, then went on, looking straight across the table into Clay's eyes.
All this they did, whoever they is. They looked at us from wherever it is they live and worship their gods, and what did they see?
Clay shook his head, fascinated by Tom's eyes shining behind his spectacles. They were almost the eyes of a visionary.
They saw we had built the Tower of Babel all over again, and on nothing but electronic cobwebs. And in a space of seconds, they brushed those cobwebs aside, and our tower fell. All this they did. And you think they could not have encoded a signal telling the affected ones to simply fall asleep and stop breathing 5 hours later? What's that trick compared to the first one? Not much, I'd say.
Clay said, I'd say it's time we got some sleep. For a moment, Tom remained as he was, hunched across the table a little, looking at Clay as if unable to understand what Clay had said. Then he laughed.
Yeah, he said.
Yeah, you've got a point. I get wound up. Sorry.
Not at all, Clay said. I hope you're right about the crazies being dead.
He paused, then said, I mean, unless my boy, Johnny G. He couldn't finish. Partly, or maybe mostly, because if Johnny had tried to use his phone this afternoon and had gotten the same call as Pixie Light and Power Suit Woman, Clay wasn't sure he wanted his son to still be alive.
Tom reached across the table to him, and Clay took the other man's delicate, long-fingered hand in both of his. He saw this happening as if he were outside his body, and when he spoke, he didn't seem to be the one speaking, although he could feel his mouth moving and the tears that had begun to fall from his eyes.
I'm so scared for him, his mouth was saying. I'm scared for both of them, but mostly for my kid.
It'll be all right, Tom said.
And Clay knew he meant well, but the words struck terror into his heart just the same, because it was just one of those things you said when there was really nothing else, like, you'll get over it, or, he's in a better place.